Welcome to a new season of the Math Ed Podcast. I'm still Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and joining me again is Egan Chernoff, who's a professor of math education at the University of Saskatchewan up in Canada. Egan, thanks for being back. It's been a few years since you were on the podcast.
Dr. Otten, thanks so much for having me back.
One of the things I love about Egan is that he's very good about promoting other people's work online, through social media and websites, and also in a special issue of the Mathematics Enthusiast. He does a really great job of grabbing people's ideas and engaging with them and putting them out there and spreading them into the world. And this recent special issue, actually a series of issues that were kind of put together into a volume of the Mathematics Enthusiast, looks at popular books that relate to mathematics or relate to mathematics education in various ways. And Egan pulled together a team of folks, myself included, to review a whole gamut of popular books that relate to mathematics. So I'm going to be talking to Egan about those issues of the Mathematics Enthusiast and how that came together. But then, because Egan is always so good about promoting other people's work, he also said, well, I have some questions for you, Sam, about the Math Ed podcast and how that spreads the word and gets out into the world in terms of math education research. So we're going to also then turn the tables, and Egan has a few questions that he wants to ask me. And I figured that could be a fun way to open up the season. So Egan, are you ready to do this with me? I'm hoping it'll be fun.
I'm ready. And thank you for entertaining my idea to flip the script.
All right. Sounds good. Well, let's go and start with this series of special issues that you put together. So how did you get the overall idea to pull these special issues together involving the book reviews?
Well, there's sort of a long answer to this, and there's a short answer to it. I sort of developed a fascination for the popularization of mathematics back when I was doing my degree. It was sort of introduction to Martin Gardner in the back pages of Scientific American, and that was something where back in the day when you used to go walk through the library and go to the library stacks and the call cards and everything, I would always find that column and paid particular attention to it. And then when I graduated, one of the gifts that my dad gave me was a book, The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, which was the story of Paul Erdős and the Search for the Mathematical Truth by Paul Hoffman. And ever since then, I've been hooked on the popularization of mathematics. But the one thing that I noticed is that the people that were never asked to talk about the popularization of mathematics were researchers in the field of math education or math educators. So I thought, what an opportunity here to pull something together where math educators are reviewing and looking at accounts of the popularization of mathematics.
Yeah, so bringing in that a whole set of math ed perspectives to kind of respond and dialogue with these books. I'm curious, though, there's a lot of books out there. How did you go about creating your list? I mean, it's not just the most recent ones that come off. You pull some old favorites, and there's kind of a mix of eras. How did that book selection come together?
To be honest with you, it is connected to my first ever sabbatical that I took at the University of Saskatchewan. So I had sort of some career aspirational goals, and I sort of deferred my first sabbatical. So 10 years into my career, I was looking at my bookshelf and I was trying to plan for the sabbatical, and I needed to let the dean and other individuals in the college know what I was going to do. And so I started looking at my bookshelf and I started looking at all the books that I had read. I looked at, my Amazon page, which had all the books that I was interested in reading. And in the background, when I'm not talking about the teaching and learning of mathematics, I sort of have a secret hobby, which is I try to write about beer league hockey. And so I have been trying to popularize for a general audience this interesting notion of gentlemen and ladies that go play beer league hockey when it's 40 below outside and you have to shovel the driveway. So I started to put all of these different ideas together, and my attempts at popularizing, coupled with all these popular accounts, I made the book list as part of this is what I plan to be doing in terms of reading to engage in the popular accounts. And then as the book reviews editor for the Mathematics Enthusiast, knowing that editor Professor Sriraman is always a fan of very big projects, I proposed the idea to him. And after we discussed sort of the details of it, it came to life.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us just a sense of some of the variety of types of books that are in there? Like you mentioned, there are some biographies of mathematicians. There are some of those books that like look at certain numbers and the history of the number and stuff. But what are some of the scope of just the books themselves?
The thing that was interesting was that there are those ones that are based upon particular topics, and that's something Charles Seif and, the biography of Zero So there were topic books. Then there was sort of like a whole subset that was connected with stochastics, more statistics and probability. And I hadn't seen the reviews of some of those books the same way that you would of other ones. And then, like you said, there's some sort of ones that are very popular. You know, we have Jordan Ellenberg and all of his work that he's been doing recently. And then sort of Hannah Fry and some other big names, Stephen Strogatz, John Allen Paulos. So it was a mixture of topics, maybe sort of neglected topics, and then sort of some new ones that are sort of garnering a lot of attention. You know, Kathy O'Neill's The Signal and the Noise. We have sort of some famous ones that are in there. So I don't think it was necessarily hit a topic, hit another topic. That's sort of like maybe a subset. And then there's just sort of popular accounts of mathematicians, like you're saying, biographies, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit of Simpsons got in there too, right?
Yes.
The math of the Simpsons. Yeah, I read that one. That was the other one that I almost, you know, wanted to review, but I think it turned out well how we split it up.
Not only the Simpsons, but the big part of that book, and I'm sure you've read it, is actually about Futurama. So the middle of it, and I was fortunate enough to have a dinner with Simon Singh once when he was visiting for the BC Association of Math Teachers. We were sort of, I was doing a breakfast thing and he was doing a keynote later on. So I was able to talk to him about it. And it's an interesting book. And obviously I recommend all of the books that are in there, but it's a fun one for people that are sort of maybe, you know, getting into the popularization of math for the first time.
Mm-hmm. So those are the books, but now you have the, you know, math educators and people from a variety of backgrounds related to education that are writing the reviews and kind of, you know, responding to the ideas in those books. So there's a lot in these issues. I can't remember the total number, but there's a lot of reviews. They're all kind of fun to read and they're all engaging in their own way. But can you give us just a little sampling of some of the kinds of reviews and people who are doing those in the special issues?
I've gone through and I've picked out a few that that I want to kind of maybe highlight with you. And this is not to not highlight all 29 of them. And we initially began, this is sort of a three numbered volume of the Mathematics Enthusiast. So there are 10 per number. So volume 20, numbers 1, 2, and 3. So we initially had 10 for each of them. And it wasn't easy pulling this project together, I'll be honest with you, during the pandemic. And so there actually is only 29, and I sort of left one of them as sort of an homage to all of the people that had to sort of differently bow out and justifiably so during the project. But we're definitely going to get to yours, Debating Mathematics Curriculum, a review of Andrew Hacker's The Math Myth, because this is something that's been fascinating me to follow, especially from Canada. But one of the ones, just to kind of give you a bit of a flavor, there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Sean Chorney at Simon Fraser University, and he reviewed Conceptions of Zero, which is Amir Akzel's Finding Zero, A Mathematician's Odyssey to Uncover the Origins of Numbers. And this one, for me, really quickly kind of highlighted the sort of the angle that I was going for. He brought a really unique angle to it where he's talking about this through Finding Nemo. And he's sort of comparing the movie Finding Nemo to Amir's book that's written about finding, you know, Conceptions of Zero, which is sort of like a tale of finding zero. But what Dr. Chorney points out is that there's these theories out there that Finding Nemo isn't really about or from the perspective of Nemo. It's from the father's perspective, Marlin. And then so this shines a whole new light on this popular account of mathematics, which Dr. Chorney sort of details. But then there's even a third theory, whether or not the account is an actual account or if it's a dream sequence. So when you start reading this review of this book and the way that it's presented, it provided a perspective for me to the book that I had read. And this one in particular on a couple of occasions where I just looked at it entirely different. And that's the power of, I think, this group of people that can look at popular accounts and kind of come at it from a unique perspective.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'll have to check that one out. And you had another sampling that you wanted to mention as well?
There is another one. And I think this one will be of particular interest to you. And the reason why I think it's of particular interest to you is not only that your choice of Andrew Hacker's The Math Myth, but there's a gentleman that used to work at UC San Diego, Dr. Masajowski. I butchered his name. I spell it wrong. He's going to hate me for it. So I'm going to call him Dr. Wes. And Dr. Wes has moved back to Canada and he's an expert in the field of calculus. So he wrote an article called The Siren Call of Calculus. And he reviewed one of many of Strogatz's books, Infinite Powers, How Calculus Reveals the Secret of the Universe. when you read it, you can actually see him struggling with loving and hating calculus and loving and hating the teaching of calculus. And it just sort of happened in a way through the editing process that on the very first page, he has a very nice introductory paragraph and there's a third paragraph, but it just stands out in the text and it just simply reads, "But I do mostly hate calculus." And there's some way that it's sitting on the page that just sort of really captured my attention. And then you kind of see him back in, "I secretly love it. Here's why I love it. Yes, it is a gatekeeper. Other people are arguing not just for the teaching and learning of mathematics. It is the gatekeeper to mathematics." And it's almost coming off of the page, his sort of struggle with this topic that he's so knowledgeable in and familiar with. So that's one that I really enjoyed as well.
Yeah, and I do. You've alluded to my review of Andrew Hacker's The Math Myths. I feel like mine has some similar themes of a little bit of this struggle and a little bit of this back and forth, and the author, or like myself as the reviewer, having a little bit of a debate with myself. So his was at the calculus level. Mine is really at just high school mathematics, like at the secondary level, the high school curriculum. Because Andrew Hacker, he's the guy that wrote, he's like an economist or political science sort of guy, but he wrote this article, "Is Algebra Necessary?" I think it was called, made a big splash everywhere. So then he got a book deal out of it, like, "Oh, I'm gonna write a whole book on the math myth." And he's talking about some of the challenges of high school math, how it turns a lot of people off. He sort of makes a valid point, I think, that math has this privilege and luxury of having multiple years to share our discipline with young people. Yep, you're stuck with math for this year and next year and the year after that and all these years of math. So it's kind of like this luxury of like, all right, we have a very good chance to put our discipline out there in front of people. And you think that we would, you know, hook a lot of people in or get a lot of people really engaged in it, but we kind of don't. And he's saying, you know, it's kind of squandering that luxury because other disciplines would love to have that much exposure. Like, think of any other discipline, area of thinking, you know, it's history, social studies parts, you know, political science, psychology, all kinds of other disciplines, anthropology. They would love to just have several years to work with young people and get them excited and show them the beauty of their discipline. But they don't have those opportunities. Math does have that opportunity, but we're kind of blowing it because we're turning more people off. And this might be, you know, speaking from the States is where I wrote from predominantly. And so I think Hacker rightly calls out some things about the curriculum, but then where does he take it? He takes it as like, well, maybe we need less math. He says these topics are the wrong topics. They're too abstract. We need to have more concrete topics. We need to have more number theory. We need to have more stats and data analysis. Now, in my review, I actually go through how I agree with a lot of his points. Like, I'm not actually taking him on, you know, as a full-on debate. But I do also point out ways in which that I thought Hacker is very much fixated on the topic being taught. And if it's the right topic, and if there's a more practical topic instead of an abstract topic. And for me, I'm like, that isn't really how I look at it. I look at it as, what is the process that students are being engaged in? What are the interactions that they're having with each other? What kind of community is that math classroom community? And for me, that's the stuff that we're kind of, you know, maybe need to get better. We need to get a better classroom community that involves more students. It doesn't marginalize or push people away. We're doing some interesting debating and reasoning and justifying and things. And so for me, I think about it more as we're not doing the right processes and the right classroom culture. And that's why we're turning people off and it's not working. He's kind of thinking, we just need to have less math, or we need to change the topics that are taught. And so we come at it from different angles. I have this little part where I say that we're thinking about high school mathematics, and Hacker says there's too much of it. I agree, but he focuses on the too much and like the quantity of what's taught in high school math. And I focus on the it, like, what is high school math? What is the it that we're doing? And I'm sort of saying, like, I think we need to do it a little bit differently, a little bit more inclusively, a little bit more with reasoning. And But you'll see in there, I think, too, my struggle of like, okay, I kind of find myself agreeing with this guy on some of the critiques of high school math. But then I think our diagnosis of what to do about it is a little bit different.
I think what you've done, and I would highly recommend yours, and it actually leads off the entire volume. And thank you for that. I think what you do is you nicely talk about the distinction between kind of mathematics and school mathematics. I think that's sort of at the root of why I have this intense interest in not just the popularization of mathematics. I think the field of math education is mature enough now for this sort of popularization of the teaching and learning of mathematics. And so the conception that people have, and maybe why these popular accounts of mathematics are not as popular as they could be, is because when people think of mathematics, and if you're writing for a general audience, the general audience is thinking of what you're talking about, high school math, elementary school mathematics. So it sort of befuddles me a bit that we have all of these people that are trying to write for a general audience, these very abstract, at the edge of mathematics ideas. And my apologies to those that are doing it or trying it. It's just not as strong as those that are like a strong body of individuals that are doing it. Who is there to popularize what it's like, you know, learning fractions or learning, you know, high school mathematics? And I think if we sort of set the table for people about, you know, here's struggles with school mathematics and teaching it and learning it and, you know, progressing through all the way to calculus, because everybody's going towards calculus. And now all of a sudden someone's saying, hold on a second, the world has changed. Maybe we should be going in this direction. I think there's an audience. There's a general audience for that, because everybody that goes to school is involved in the teaching and learning of mathematics.
Hmm. And there's a big audience of people who have experienced some sort of high school algebra. And so they have a little bit of a background that they can connect to or whatever, but they might be like, oh, here's a book or here's something, documentary, you know, YouTube series or something, but here's something popularized that's maybe going to give me a different angle at high school algebra. Like maybe it was different than I thought it was or than I experienced it. And that might be actually like a fun experience for them as an adult to be like, oh, I'm going to revisit high school algebra, but from a totally different person ushering me through it.
There is a book that currently came out, and I can't remember. It was discussed in the New York Times about a gentleman that goes back and learns mathematics again, I think in his 60s or something along those lines. And my apologies for not remembering the author's name. I'm only maybe 5-10 pages into it. The power of that, I think, is there. And I'll give an example. I even do this with future math teachers. The number file video series is very appealing to me, and they do a great job of sort of like popularizing ideas. And so I was trying to get to a group of secondary high school math teachers that were sort of like, we get it, buddy, we're high school math teachers. And they did this job about how to order 43 chicken McNuggets at McDonald's, and it's a famous number file video. And it was very interesting to see a group of people that are well-versed in mathematics and school mathematics to be talking about Frobenius numbers, because there were these people trying to order chicken McNuggets. And it was sort of there for me that I kind of saw maybe the power of getting to individuals. You and I both know tons of writing about, you know, you have to come to the students where they are, has to be grounded in real life, et cetera. And we have a bunch of examples, and I call them broccoli and cheese examples. You know, like you take a word problem and you kind of throw SpongeBob in there. Well, it's not relating to the students. You're just getting them to eat the broccoli because you've dumped so much cheese on it. This ordering of the chicken McNuggets, the whole room was transfixed on this. They started working on it, it extended, et cetera. So I kind of saw the power, I guess, for lack of a better word, of the popularization, and they do a fantastic job, so much so that they have, you know, like a huge series of videos, and it's almost recommended watching for my courses.
Mm-hmm. So that leads me to the last kind of main question I wanted to ask you in this zone of popularization. What are your thoughts for our field about what role math educators should be playing in popularizing mathematics, or maybe popularizing school mathematics or math education? And do you see a role for researchers or scholars? Do you see a role for teachers? Just shed a little bit of light, because I know you've thought about this for a bit. Where do you see, you know, some of the needs in our field?
I think what you're saying, and we kind of touched on it maybe a little bit earlier, the field of math education is, I think, mature enough to handle, you know, popular accounts. And there are a few individuals that are sort of popularizing. But I mean, if you just went down the laundry list of all the people that are popularizers of mathematics, you know, there's Alex Bellos, we have, you know, Marcus Dusatoy, we have Steven Strogatz, John Allen Paulos, Ian Stewart, Keith Devlin, like the list just goes on. And I think if we had individuals that sort of dedicated time the same way that you've dedicated time, I think you're actually popularizing the field of math education quite well. It's through a different venue than, say, writing about it. But there is the popularization of the sort of research in math education. I don't see people kind of talking about going to conferences or, you know, writing articles, or that's happening in other areas. But I think the key is the teaching. If you wanted to get to a general audience, the key would be to talk about the teaching and learning of mathematics, because it sort of exists in the ether, but there's no person that has sort of maybe, in my opinion, captured the, there's no Keith Devlin of the teaching and learning of mathematics, even though Keith Devlin does spend a lot of time on the teaching and learning of mathematics, who will be the math educator or researcher in math education. And there could be multiple ones, like you're saying, it does not have to be a researcher in math education. You know, there's math teachers that are very eloquent at doing this and doing it differently with maybe YouTube or something along those lines. I think it's an interesting area for the field to go further. And I hope to see it. And I'm trying to do my part a little bit. I've been trying my own attempts to popularize the teaching and learning of mathematics. There's a column called Math Ed Matters that I wrote for a local math teacher journal here. It's not around anymore, but I've sort of started to morph this to Canadian Math Ed Matters, which is sort of a regular viewpoint that comes out in the Canadian Journal of Science, Math, and Technology Education. So full disclosure, I am attempting to do this while I'm asking others to do it as well.
Yeah, and if listeners are aware of some teachers or some educators that are really doing a good job of shedding light on math education topics, but in a way that the general public could really latch onto, share those with us. We can kind of push those out amongst the podcast channel. And I also, you know, recognize, you know, Egan and I as white men talking about this, and a lot of the popularizers on the mathematics side are also white men. I do think, you know, it'd be important to have a lot of different voices that are doing the popularizing, because it might resonate or it might connect with more people in different ways.
I couldn't agree more. And I'd be remiss not to mention how well Hannah Fry over in the UK is doing with her popular accounts as well. And I love her work. And if you haven't read all of it, it's worth dedicating a lot of your time, because there's lots of good stuff there.
Yeah. Well, I do appreciate your remarks about the podcast. It's funny because I don't think of it quite in the same way, but I see the point you're making. I just always thought of the podcast as talking to researchers. It's very much in a research space, but conversational. So like, we're going to have conversational discussions about research. But to me, it was still like a conversational modality, but still operating within math ed scholarship. And then when I think of popularization, I think of it as translating scholarship or from the academy, translating it to a different audience, like putting it out there so the general public connects with it. Now, I see what you're saying, though, because it turns out that actually a lot of the general public actually does listen to the podcast. You know, people that are just interested in math ed or teachers who are not in a research zone, they just listen to it because they enjoy the conversations or the insights. So I see how it actually has turned out to have some popularizing sorts of effects, but that wasn't, you know, like the mission. Like, I didn't say, let's do a podcast that can just go far and wide to parents and to, you know, just school leaders and stuff, for them to tap into math ed. So there's a little difference, but I can see the connection.
Well, that just leads right into a question I'd like to ask you. I mean, sure. This math ed podcast is very well established now, but could you maybe take the listeners and me back to 2012? Because podcasts weren't as big as they are now. And, you know, the standing joke is that every stand-up comedian has a podcast, and you look at how many podcasts there are. Like, what were you thinking way back in 2012 when this all started?
Yeah, in 2012, you know, there were definitely some podcasts, but it was not the big thing that the, you know, the pervasive thing that it is now. But really, we can thank Michigan State University's parking costs, because I was a graduate student trying to save money, make it through on, you know, very little income. And I refused for several years to pay the parking costs for Michigan State. So I'm like, I'm going to walk to campus. And then later, when I was a little farther away, I took the bus, the city bus to campus every day. So I have all these, you know, walking commutes or bus riding commute. And there were some podcasts happening at the moment. And this was, I didn't have a smartphone or anything. I was just downloading MP3s onto an MP3 player and then just carrying that with me and listening to them. So during my commutes to Michigan State's campus, I was listening to some podcasts, but I was listening to, you know, DC comic books or comedy or, you know, current events, like not math ed. The thought came to me towards the end of grad school that it would be helpful if, while I'm commuting and just listening, if I was actually getting some work done, quote unquote, getting some work done. So I'm like, oh, if there was a podcast that I could just hear about some studies or some research that I need to read, then I'm kind of, you know, getting that taken care of while I'm commuting or while I'm doing whatever. So that was kind of the insight, was like, oh, if there was a math ed one of these podcasts, then I could be doing that. It was also impactful to me at Michigan State when we had authors call into our doc class. And we had that several times. We would have, you know, hey, the faculty member knows the author, so they're going to call in during our class session and we're going to talk about their article. And I did notice that whenever we had the author call in, I really remembered those articles. Like, they stood out in a totally different way with more depth than the other stuff that I just straight read. So for me, I kind of put that together, like, oh, I could just simulate those phone calls where we just get to ask some questions to the author, and then hopefully it brings to life the studies and it makes them more memorable to whoever wants to listen. But I waited until I actually got my faculty position at Mizzou to start it, because final year of grad school with job search, having a kid, and getting the dissertation done was busy enough. So I was smart enough to wait until I arrived in Missouri, and then I started it up.
It's interesting for me to hear from you that you didn't really think of it as popularization of mathematics education. And maybe that's because you thought of it more as service to maybe your university and the larger academic community, because I definitely see it as service. I see it as popularization. But I guess, like, is this something that your university counts, for lack of a better word, as service to the field of math education research?
So yes. So before I started it, I actually did talk to my department chair and I said, I have this idea, you know, here's what I'm thinking, here's how many hours I expect it to take, you know. And my department chair was James Tarr at the time, John Lannon and James Tarr, kind of both. And they said it sounded like a good idea. And they said they think that people would listen and it would be helpful as a way to help, you know, spread research around, mostly viewing it, like you said, as service to the math education scholarly community. So they said, we will count that, like, as credit towards your service efforts on the professional level. So I'm like, okay, cool. As long as I know it's counting for something, I think it'll be fun. I want to do it. But some people are surprised to know, like, I don't have any funding for it. So right from the start, I just paid out of pocket for the podcast hosting and the website fees and all that stuff. I've gotten donations at various times throughout the years, but I don't really push too hard for donations. But some people think, you know, oh, the university sponsors it. And it's like, nope, I actually have never gotten a dollar from the university for it. So they haven't supported it in a financial way, but I have gotten very high marks for service, which has been nice. And from the field, I have gotten a lot of gratitude. A lot of people tell me that they appreciate my efforts, that it makes a big difference, that they use it in their grad classes, or with pre-service teachers. And the AMTE, that committee, awarded me for a service award. So I definitely feel the love from the math ed community, and, you know, makes me happy to sort of keep doing it more than a decade in now.
Yeah, more than a decade. And I would not only applaud you for your service and your popularization, but I would actually call it sustained service. And the reason I would say that is because I was flipping through, and I think we're episode 181 or something along those lines.
Yeah,
I
mean, right, the around numbers, 180, depending on how you count them. Yeah,
the numbers are staggering. And one of the things I saw when I was going through them, there was a sort of like a celebratory 100th episode in October of 2017. So one of the things that I don't know whether it's connected with your 100th episode or not is that the digest begins after that point. So could you maybe tell us about your celebration for the 100th episode, whether you plan to celebrate the 200th episode, and where this digest came about?
Yeah, the 100th was just, I felt like, you know, it had been many years coming. I felt like it was good to do something. My idea was to get more voices in, so I asked other people to contribute stuff. And it was fun to put together. The digest episode came from conversations with my colleague Chuck Munter about other ways of using the podcast space. And, you know, an interview with somebody in depth is great. It's great for depth, but maybe not great for coverage. And so we were thinking, like, well, what if there were some small hitters where it's like, all right, you come here, you hear about like three or four interesting articles that are out, and it's just a quick summary of each one of those. And so it might bring some awareness to those articles. So that was the idea through conversation with Chuck. And I said, you know, okay, that's great, but like reading articles and summarizing them is a little bit more work. And like, well, what if we put a team together? So I tried to compile a team of collaborators, and they were all awesome and, you know, did really thoughtful jobs of bringing their perspectives on some of the articles. It is more legwork, as you know, to kind of manage multiple people. So I sometimes would drop the ball because it's not as easy as like, oh, I'll just take care of it when I, you know, get home for the evening or whatever. And also then the pandemic hit and it's like, okay, it's not our top priority. You know, we have other things that everybody was trying to deal with and, you know, keep balls up in the air. So, you know, the digests have slowed down now, but I'm still very open to them. And I could actually probably, you know, revisit my team of contributors, or maybe if people are listening now and they feel like, I'd love to do a 2-minute or 5-minute summary of thoughts that are on your mind or things that you're reading in math ed, let me know, because I might be able to pull together a new team of contributors and we might be able to do that. 200th episode. I definitely assume I should do something. I have not quite thought of it yet. It might be a year out or so, depending on my productivity with these episodes. So also people, if they have an idea for what would be really cool in the 200th episode, I'm always open to ideas. So,
well, you know, the thing, and I meant it about the sustained service. I mean, 180 episodes. I have a few questions about someone that's been doing something kind of for so long. And I started looking through your list of people that you've interviewed, and definitely big names from the field of mathematics education, big names from actually the popularization of mathematics. You know, John Allen Paulos, Ian Stewart in 2018 and 21, respectively. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself inviting other popularizers to the Math Ed podcast?
Yeah, I'm open to it. So I actually get pretty frequently, I get requests from book publicists and they say, you know, our author has this book coming out. Can they promote it on the podcast? And I usually say no to that sort of thing because I try to keep my eye on the ball that this is like math ed research. And I like to have an empirical basis for most of like what we're talking about. But I can't help it every once in a while. I just love to throw in something. Often I'll do it like at the end of the year. I'll throw in something that's a little bit of a stretch, a little bit more fun. Not that research isn't fun, but just something that's a little bit like, oh, let's just talk about something that's an interesting topic in math ed, but not necessarily a study per se. So I'm always open to that. I usually like to have a little bit more say in selecting them and not just have a publicist that's pushing it onto me. So I usually do decline the publicist things reaching out. But yeah, I do have, you know, the library built. I have the listenership intact. You know, we get well over 2,000, you know, downloads or streams like for each episode. Some episodes get like 4,000, 5,000, you know, depending on the topic or how it spreads. So I have this, you know, pathway of pushing things out. And I do realize that that's pretty powerful and I'm happy to sort of share it. And so, yeah, I think popularizing, it could use that avenue as well. Like, okay, this is going to hit a lot of math educators, a lot of math teachers, and actually worldwide, you know, people who are thinking about math ed topics.
I want to thank you for letting me kind of flip the script between the interviewer and the interviewee. Do you mind if I ask you just a couple more questions before we head out?
Yeah, you know what? We're here anyway. Let's go for it.
I'm super curious. And this is something that when I tell people that I'm writing about beer league hockey essays and they just sort of say, you know, like, why are you doing that? Where else could you have sunk your time? Mm-hmm. There's a similar thing going on here. And I'm not sure whether you hear it or not, but has anybody ever approached you and said, Sam, if you're not doing the podcast, what would you be doing?
I think, you know, there might've been a little bit of YouTube dabbling. You know, I made a few YouTube videos at one point that were related to math education, but I felt more comfortable being the interviewer and having somebody else do most of the talking. And I also felt a little bit more comfortable being like off camera. There's some people, you know, that are great on camera and they're doing TikTok and they're doing YouTube and all that stuff. And for me, it's kind of fitting where it's like, all right, you guys do that. I'll be happy doing my audio sort of thing. So that's kind of in the same vein of like, you know, how would I be contributing to the conversation in math ed if I wasn't doing the podcast? I do think, though, I would have probably dabbled a little bit more in YouTube and maybe I would have gotten a little bit better at it or more comfortable with it. On the personal level, I do a lot of my editing at home. So I really try to work in the office. And then when I go home, I try to not really do much work. But editing the audio is one thing that I can do at home where it's like, all right, I'm on the couch. Let me just pull up this audio file and start cleaning it, you know, and producing it. So if I wasn't doing the podcast, honestly, I probably would just be doing family stuff or watching some DC movies or reading a bit more, playing with the kids. It probably is the case that the podcast work has taken away a little bit from just home time.
You know, you put me on the spot earlier in this interview and you asked me to pick a few out of the 29 articles to sort of highlight. I'm going to do the same thing to you. And of the 180-ish interviews, is there one that you're most proud of? And if so, why?
Yeah, it's hard to pick favorites, right? I know. Yeah, but thank you for doing that when it was on your side. I have kind of an easy escape hatch here, though, because some of my favorites are the career retrospective episodes. In my mind, I call them the career episodes. And some of those have been really meaningful. And I've just felt very thrilled and lucky to do those. So Jeremy Kilpatrick, like getting to talk mm-hmm. to him about different points in his career was just amazing. Having Tom Carpenter on the podcast was very cool. Liz Fenema, Glenda Lappin, like really there's a whole set. If you look at my list of episodes and you search for the word career, you'll pull up these ones where we kind of have these larger looks across decades of like their thinking and how it evolved. And it gives us also these traces of what was happening in the field. So honestly, they're not the bread and butter of the podcast. There's usually only one or two a year, but they are, you know, probably my favorite, to be honest. Or after they're done and I'm looking back on it, those are the ones that stick out.
Those were some of my favorites as well, to be honest with you. Okay, I got two more questions for you. And this comes out of the pandemic for me, which is that I have been sort of asking people for work and personal recommendations. So if I'm, you know, talking with somebody at the grocery store, I'll ask them for a recommendation. But you're, in my opinion, a wealth of knowledge about the field of math education, research in math education. So not just for me, but maybe for the listeners, do you have a recommendation, a book, an article, a conference paper, some video, some podcast that you would definitely recommend for someone who has some time on their hands?
I don't know about wealth of knowledge, but there is an article that I can recommend that has been on my mind ever since I read it. It's Sinha and Kapoor from 2021, and they did this meta-analysis that was published in the Review of Educational Research. And I've been thinking about it for the whole year since I read it. They analyzed like a decade of studies that looked at teacher-led instruction and then kind of student-involved problem solving. And they looked at studies that talked about the sequence of those things. Like, do you teach first and then have students problem solve or do some exercises? Or do you have students engage a little bit in problem solving before you kind of teach or have the teacher-led portion of the instruction? So for me, that question of the sequence to me is a really like fruitful thing to think about. To me, it's more fruitful to think about the sequencing and the balance between those two than it is like debate, teacher-led versus student-centered or instruction versus discovery or whatever. For me, that sequencing is like, okay, this is the nuance that I feel like is helpful for a lot of people. And they found this very strong effect, positive effect at the middle and high school level, mostly in mathematics, for having the students do even just a little bit of problem solving, like have them try it out first, have them get some thoughts together first and some curiosity or some questions. And then you can have the teacher sort of like explain it and kind of talk them through how to make sense of it. That simple idea, but the fact that it was so robustly shown at the middle and high school level in mathematics context as a positive thing to have a little bit of problem solving before the instruction has just helped me make sense of a lot of phenomenon I was seeing in my own research and interactions I was having with pre-service teachers. You know, I had a pre-service teacher that was saying, you know, I think I'm better than my host teacher. And I'm like, whoa, you know, I applaud the confidence, but like, let's break that down a little bit. And what this pre-service teacher was experiencing was the host teacher was teaching a topic and the students were not really getting it and they were trying it out and they were kind of getting stuck. And then the pre-service teacher who's just observing or, you know, assisting in the class would come over when they were stuck while they were working and would explain it to them. And then the students would be like, oh, I got it. Aha, that makes sense now. So the pre-service teacher was thinking, wow, I'm explaining it better than the host teacher was. But thinking of Sinha and Kapoor's meta-analysis, to me, it's like, no, you were just there at the right moment. They had to work on it a little bit and get a little bit of confusion or a little bit of questions so that they were ready to receive the explanation. That was the difference. It's not that the host teacher explained it poorly. It's just that the host teacher explained it prematurely. So there's a lot of moments like that that this article has given clarity to me. And I also just think it was a very solidly, like, well-done meta-analysis. So that's my recommendation. And I'm thinking about trying to write up these little anecdotes about how this article has given me clarity on some things. And I feel like that might be worth sharing, although I haven't written it up yet.
I imagine myself digging through Google Scholar and seeing that coming up and then hitting that little button that says related articles. And I imagine Debating Mathematics Curriculum, a review of Andrew Hacker's The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions by Sam Otten in The Mathematics Enthusiast being on that list of related articles.
Mm-hmm. All comes together, right?
So I can't let you go without one last question, and I guess you're letting me go at some point, but you were talking about, you know, walking in without paying for parking, and I did a similar thing here in Saskatoon for a number of years, and I had podcasts going in as well. You also mentioned something about the DC universe. So mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm really interested in, let's get to know a little bit more, I guess, for me about the host, and do you have a non-math education recommendation, a TV show, a movie, a song, a book, a podcast, something like that you'd recommend for your listeners where we can get a window into Dr. Otten a bit?
Yeah, awesome. Well, I love movies. Some of my favorite directors are the Coen brothers, Stanley Kubrick, Alfred Hitchcock, some of the big ones. But one of my very favorite movies, people might be surprised, but it's Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. I love that movie. You know, there's a whole community of people who have made really deep connections out of it. There's philosophy in there. There's a critique of toxic masculinity. These, like, you know, two rich, powerful men that just can't handle somebody being like over top of them. And then they go in really negative directions with that. And then the women in the movie are actually pointing out that toxic masculinity all the way along and like busting right through it. There's all kinds of great stuff in that movie. Speaking of podcasting, just for fun, I also did a podcast where I kind of analyzed through the themes and the philosophical connections and stuff through Batman v Superman. So that's a movie that I love. I've gotten so much meaning out of it in my life and in thinking. And a lot of people either kind of watched it and were like, nah, didn't like it. Or a lot of people didn't watch it. They just saw the like public sort of narrative about it, which is like, oh yeah, that's overblown. It's Batman and Superman and it's silly. And it's ironic because the movie Batman v Superman, one of the themes is actually that the public can just jump on a narrative and then they can sort of be out of control. And to me, that's also what happened with the movie, was that it pretty quickly became this narrative of an overblown superhero movie that's, you know, jumped the shark kind of thing. And for me, it's like, no, that's not what I see in that movie at all. But yeah, that's the one I would recommend people, you know, take a different look at, a second look at it if you haven't already. I know a lot of people who, all I do is I say like, hey, watch it through the lens of, you know, toxic masculinity and see it as a critique of toxic masculinity. Okay, go for it. And people, when they watch it again, they're like, oh yeah, I got a lot more out of it the second time than they did like the first time they saw it. Give it another chance if you've already prejudged it or if you judged it based on your first viewing.
Well, Sam, thanks so much for that. And like I said, for letting me kind of flip the script, I definitely should turn it back to you here as we, I guess we're wrapping up.
Yeah, we're wrapping up together, Egan. Now, this was fun. I really enjoyed the conversation. The special issue of The Mathematics Enthusiast, you know, people can go and grab the ones that they're interested in, but I believe it's freely available, right? Like it's open access online.
Absolutely. And as we've been doing the podcast, there's actually a front page that shows all of the different downloads from around the world. And there's been a few of the articles we've been discussing being downloaded during this podcast. So that's fun to see.
All right. Awesome. Well, Egan, it's great talking to you again, and have a great year.
Thanks so much, Sam.